It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Julie Perkins. On today's show, we're having a reporters' roundtable to discuss hot topics in the federal workforce. Our roundtable will also predict what trending topics we'll see for the rest of 2014. We have Eric Katz from GovExec, Jason Miller from Federal News Radio, Zach Rousnitz from Fierce Government here with us in the studio. We also have Joe Marks from NextGov joining us on the phone. Just a reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on GEICO, go to geico.com. Before we get going, I thought I'd give you a good opportunity to introduce yourself. So why don't we start with you, Zach?
Hi, I'm Zach Rousnitz. I'm with Fierce Government. I mainly cover the Homeland Security Department, but I dabble in a little bit of everything related to federal agencies.
Eric?
Eric Katz from Government Executive, govexec.com. I cover federal workforce issues, pay and benefits, a lot of postal service.
And Jason.
Yeah, Jason Miller, Federal News Radio. This is great. Thanks for having me on again. I think the last time we did the Reporters Roundtable, it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So I think this one will be, there's a lot to talk about, so good timing. I cover a little bit of everything, mostly spend a lot of time with IT, a lot of procurement, but as I think Eric will attest to, that you can't get away from the workforce because it's such an important issue to all our audience. And then, then there's the management issues as well. That's obviously all connected. It runs through all the other topics.
And Joe Marks.
Hi, Julie. Thanks for having me, too. I write for NextGov, which is a partner site to GovExec, and I cover mainly technology in the federal workforce, so anything involving large procurements, small procurements, mobility, open data, all sorts of things having to do with the way the government does technology now and would like to do it in the future.
Okay, great. I thought we'd first start with the Ryan budget that just was passed yesterday. Jason, what effect, if anything, did it have on the federal workforce?
A lot of what they're proposing is the idea of, well, it's rehashing kind of some of the old ideas that we've seen before. Well, let's replace for every one person, three people who retire from the government, let's bring back one. It's rehashing some of the same kind of ideas of cuts, not just to the workforce, but the ideas around maybe even paying benefits. It's not presenting any, if you will, new ideas to improving the federal workforce, to changing the federal workforce in a way that people could say, okay, we can get behind this, especially the Democrats, especially the Obama administration. I mean, everyone talks about the Obama budget being dead on arrival. This budget is, got through the House, but it's not going to get anywhere in the Senate. It's more of a, I think, just like the administration's priorities, it's a show of politics, unfortunately.
It also, specifically on the pay and benefits, would raise their contribution rates to their pensions up to 6.3% around that area, which is something that Obama has proposed previously but did not include in his most recent budget. And it's effectively a pay cut. It takes money out of federal employees' paycheck without giving them anything else in return.
Do you think, I've been reading the news, and it seems to me that Congress or maybe the administration as well is focusing on how to streamline procurement or IT across the executive branch. Joe, can you speak to that? Are they looking for cost savings there?
Yes, hopefully cost savings and also just some more rationale. I think healthcare.gov really opened up the eyes of people in Congress and also across the viewing and reading public that government procurement has reached a point that it's overly complicated and you're getting diminishing returns for what you're putting together. So there was a real move soon after the healthcare.gov troubles to get the Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act through the House, and there's a version of it that's now awaiting movement in the Senate. There was a lot of movement on that at first. It began before healthcare.gov went live, sponsored in the House by Daryl Issa and Jerry Connolly, who are two of the leading technologists in the House. Didn't get as much traction once healthcare.gov got into trouble. It seemed Congress sees a problem, they want to do something about it, and this is an easy thing to do. Since open enrollment has ended and since healthcare.gov hit its enrollment targets sort of despite several self-inflicted wounds, I think it's probably an open question whether the real push for IT reform is going to keep going or if that's going to fizzle a little bit because it's less on everyone's minds.
I think Joe's absolutely right. I mean, I was really surprised that FITAR did not get through they attached it to the National Defense Authorization Bill. And I was really expecting, with the failure of, the debacle that was healthcare.gov, if there's any time that Congress would actually do something around IT and procurement, which they tend not to understand, they tend not to get, they tend not to really care too much about until something happens, this was it. So when it didn't get through, it really left my scratching my head a little bit, because does that mean the administration didn't support it? Or did that mean someone in the Senate wasn't happy? Like, the rationale behind it was really tough. I know Steve Van Roekel, the federal CIO, has been very, and I'll use the word tepid on it. Well, we think we kind of support certain pieces of it. From my perspective, I thought they would have pushed through the bill because of healthcare.gov. And since then, you've heard a lot of promises from OMB, from the CIO, the Deputy Director for Management, Beth Colbert, saying, oh, we're going to do something. Oh, no, we really are going to do something around IT and procurement. Yet you haven't seen what that is. I mean, they've offered these three broad perspectives of better acquisition, people, and I think processes, but there's no meat yet on the bone.
Yeah, one thing you have seen, just add on to what Jason said, is just a couple of days ago, the General Services Administration announced a plan for something that looks a little bit like what was proposed in FITAR, the IT Reform Act, which is adding more expertise on certain categories of management within GSA, and then adding a web and human-based portal that gives more guidance on particular types of categories of procurement, whether it's IT, whether it's services or something like that. That seems to be a feint in the direction of trying to rationalize this a little bit. Whether that will actually simplify things or not is an open question, and one that won't even begin to be answered for the next year or two.
Interesting. It seems to me that it's going a bit piecemeal rather than an overall approach. Some agencies are trying to implement modernization programs, and I would imagine that they're developing their own technology, and is it possible that agencies are not going to be able to speak to each other technology-wise, or is there an overall plan?
Well, there's no overall plan per se, but what the OMB has done over the last 5 years, and really before that, but the last 5 years, they've really pushed for this idea of interoperability, open standards, the idea that if you move to the cloud, here's your baseline security standard, so everyone will at least have a starting spot there, and then the push to understanding that proprietary systems is not the answer anymore. Now, in some ways, it's less about, will my system talk to your system, but will our data be interoperable? So if my system can talk to Eric's system, that is less important than can Eric's system accept my data? And mm-hmm. I think that's where the open data policy has come in, and that's been a huge push. I know, Joe, you've covered that a whole lot. From your perspective, I'll ask you a question. Do you think that's the key to this, is that data piece?
I think largely, yeah, that absolutely it is. And not just for making systems function better and saving money now, but for the long-term future of making government more efficient, allowing government to do things in a more efficient manner across the federal, state, local level. Being able to share data in a reasonable way is absolutely the key to that.
I think also in a way it makes sense for this to happen sort of bit by bit in agencies instead of having one giant bill, because if the bill's going to have teeth and it's trying to solve a huge problem like this, It's hard to craft it in a precise enough way that it's not going to cause additional problems.
And I actually think that's part of the reason if Atari didn't get through this past time is because people in the Senate, from what I've heard, and even at OMB, had some concerns about that exact thing that Zach was talking about is, well, is this too prescriptive? And you know, what? How does DoD fit in here? Maybe DoD doesn't fit in here. And then are you missing half the IT budget at that point? So I think that's part of the reason. But I go back to what I said earlier. I was just almost flabbergasted that Fatari didn't go through given healthcare.gov.
Huh. And if you see that sort of playing out already, the agencies wanting to build their technology to be used all throughout government, the Office of Personnel Management has talked about wanting to reform and overhaul their retirement processing system. And right now they're ran into some pushback because it's really paper-based, which is sort of outdated. And the new director, Catherine Archuleta, has talked about wanting to overhaul that process. And she's mentioned the importance of making sure that the system that they build for that isn't just for retirement processing, but something that can be used throughout government.
Oh, interesting.
I love the fact that OPMs go down this path again. This is literally the fourth time in the last 15 years that they're going to say, oh, another technology plan to fix. We got it this time. I know it. And it's been a failure every single time. And it's not just a failure of the contractor. It's been a failure, I think, of OPM because they're trying to do too much. And it's a shoving a square peg in a round hole or whatever, because the government processes are so complicated that no one could ever build a system that answers all the questions. And I think in some ways, what John Barry was doing at OPM was first getting people to the problem. I think that was a great answer. And then doing the agile development piece, I think that's going to be really what we'll, if we see a change this time around, if they really stick to that iterative approach, we're going to address part A, and then we're going to address part B, and versus the what they commonly call try to eat the elephant in one bite.
And maybe we'll eventually get the paperwork out of that mine in Pennsylvania, right?
It's a pretty cool place to work. I mean, I work in a mine. I mean, we work in office space, but
right. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm joined by Eric Katz from GovExec, Jason Miller from Federal News Radio, Zach Ralnitz from Fierce Government, and Joe Marks from NextGov. We'll continue our fascinating discussion after this break and a word from our sponsor.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym. And it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're discussing the hot topics in the federal workforce. I thought we'd just continue on a little bit more with the OPM IT modernization plan. As I understand it, it is not just about retirement and USA jobs, but it is supposed to be about performance management, a whole host of government personnel functions. Joe, do you have more information about that?
I have not covered this real directly, and maybe Eric or Jason can speak to it better. I think what we were saying before the break probably fits into this, too, that when you deal with a large overhaul, the sweet spot is trying to make it not so large that you take on too much and swallow the elephant in one bite or do too little and really don't change anything and you have another USA Jobs debacle.
Let me just jump in as well, because one of the things that OPM's plan and Catherine Archuleta promised during her confirmation hearing, to come up with this 100 plan within their first 100 days. And retirement systems is a huge piece of it, and we can kind of laugh about the problems OPM has had. But part of it is really looking at OPM from a whole and saying, okay, how can we address the technology that runs the agency? And this includes things like even like shared services, where OPM is trying to dip their toe back in the water as a service provider to agencies. How can they make sure that they have the technology in place to support that idea of shared services, whether it's retirement systems or services or whatever else? The other thing that they're looking at is from the idea of internal systems, how do we serve their customers better? So USA Jobs would get a relook again. I used USA Jobs just the other day. I was looking for the CIO jobs. And one of the things that I noticed was, okay, I used to get a feed and then my feed expired. But why would it expire? I mean, some of these government systems are really head scratchers, and I don't know if there's rules and regulations saying that you can only get a feed from the government for 90 days or a year or whatever it is. But it's just a head scratcher, certain things like that. I mean, I could get on a soapbox about FedBizOps. I don't know if you guys ever use FedBizOps.
Absolutely.
Worst in government. But let me digress back to OPM. So you wonder if they're kind of looking at these things, saying, how can we do things better? And then also, I think recruitment and retention issues, how can we deal with training? And I think OPM is looking at it from that really broad spectrum of providing IT services in a better way.
It seems to me, I was just talking to someone yesterday who had applied for several government jobs, and they're in the black hole. You know, they just disappear. They hear we'll be processing. And I think that sort of lends to a disinterest in pursuing jobs. I know with DHS, there was a dramatic level of vacancies at the high level in the senior executive position. Zach, is that still the case over there?
No. In fact, the good news is they filled most of the major positions that at least 4 months ago or so were vacant. I think in December, they were missing a secretary, deputy secretary, the head of CBP, head of ICE, several of other component heads, the CFO, the undersecretary for management. So a ton of positions. And since December, they got a new secretary, Jay Johnson, a new deputy secretary, and gradually have been filling those in. So I think that'll be a big step for the agency.
This is a major problem across government. I mean, you go to every single agency and you will find what I consider too many vacancies at this time of the administration. And with the big news from yesterday of Kathleen Sebelius resigning and then the potential or the expected announcement that OMB Director Sylvia Burwell will go over there or be at least nominated for that position, it's again another head scratcher. Is they're almost eating their own children. Why are you moving someone who has only been at OMB for less than a year to a job at HHS? Not that she's not qualified, but it's a disregard for the importance of certain management roles. And I think DHS is another example where, you know, you didn't have the deputy secretary left. You had an acting who was it's a head scratcher why it's so hard to find people. And I don't know if it's a lobbyist rules or what, but I think that the OMB decision, the decision to move Sylvia Burwell out of OMB in itself shows just the lack of disregard in many ways that this administration brings to the importance of good management. Not that Sylvia Burwell, again, would not be qualified or not be a good manager at HHS, but the importance, the lack of understanding of importance at OMB.
It's not the it's not the first time that he's tapped OMB for
Jack Lew.
Jack Lew, was head of OMB and then became his chief of staff.
Yeah, and as you go down the ranks, this goes back to what we were saying earlier, that it creates a lack of continuity and sort of a lack of morale among federal workers when you don't know, A, where your money is coming from, and B, who's going to be your boss going down the road.
In some way, I think it makes sense that they went with Burwell, though, because I think no matter who they nominated for HHS, it was going to be a very controversial position, because this is another opportunity for people who oppose the Affordable Care Act to bring up a lot of their issues with it. And Sylvia Matthews Burwell is someone who just 1 year ago was confirmed in the Senate 96-0. So, I think there will probably be less opposition to her than there might be for other people. So it'll be a little easier for the administration.
But I don't think it's a matter of she's qualified or not qualified. And whoever you bring in, if you bring in someone from the outside or another deputy secretary from VA or DOD that moves over. It's the idea that OMB once again is going to be without a director. So then you have Beth Colbert, who is the deputy director for management, who's fairly new to government. In fact, she's only been around since the fall and really has no previous government experience. And then you have the other DDM for budget. I can't think of his name off now, Brian Deese. So does he become acting? And if he becomes acting, what does that do to the budget side? I mean, there is this flow down effect that really affects the management across the government. And I think OMB and the government, from a management perspective, has suffered from that lack of consistency from OMB. Again, this is nothing about the people who are there. There are very good people there. It's the White House's lack of understanding. And I would make this point around OPM, and I would make this point around GSA, lack of understanding about the importance of these agencies to making sure the government runs well. And I see this mainly from this administration, but I think the last two have also suffered from that same issue.
With respect to, I've been reading recently about the VA senior executive bills that have been floating around the House. I would imagine that that would make recruitment even harder for another agency that I think is almost an afterthought for this administration.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that the employee groups and the unions are really worried about. There's a couple bills specifically targeting Veterans Affairs. There's one bill that would make it easier to fire a senior executive employee. It would give the secretary direct authority to do it, cut out some of the red tape involved with that process. And then there's another bill that would put a freeze on, a 5-year freeze on bonuses. This has been for senior executives, it's been a really big issue for Jeff Miller, who chairs the Veterans Affairs Committee in the House. He's pointed out many, many, many times that there seems to be a disconnect between performance and these bonuses that are supposed to be based on performance. And, you know, there was a GAO report about within the last few months about VA employees who are overseeing hospitals that are not performing well, and there are suspended doctors who are receiving bonuses and people practicing without a license, and they're still getting their bonuses. So it's something that he's really been targeting. And that bill has actually cleared the House, I'm sure, dead on arrival in the Senate. And the other one is floating through committee.
What's really interesting about the Veterans Affairs Committee, and I've been covering this, the cyber angle of this issue very closely. I haven't done so much in the personnel side. Jack Moore and our staff has. But from a cyber perspective, this committee is yes, it's run by Republicans, but I don't get the sense that they are overly political. They're not saying, well, we hate them because they are Democrats in you know, running VA or in the White House. They believe that there's something inherently wrong with how VA is being run, whether it's Secretary Shinseki or some of the people that work for him, and they just want it fixed. Now, is this the way to dock SES bonuses? I don't know if that's the best way, but it's interesting that this political that their efforts have been so, I think, considered politically charged in an unfortunate way, because this is, in my opinion, one of the times that it's not politically charged. If you want to look at the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, you know, that we can talk all day about politically charged.
Right. Well, it's definitely an issue that both sides, as far as the processing the disability claims for veterans, is both sides, both parties are very much up in arms about, and there has been some progress, but I think, just like you're saying, there's sort of a, are they really making a sincere effort to improve the issue by attacking the bureaucrats and their pay, or is that just sort of a sideshow?
One thing that struck me about this bill in the House trying to give the VA more authority to fire senior executives is I can't think of another time where lawmakers were trying to give an agency more flexibility and more power. It was actually the agency that didn't want to be given it. It's usually the opposite. So, I understand the sort of employee concerns that are in play, but I would have to think that there are people at the VA that would be perfectly fine with having this authority.
Secretary Shinseki has himself said that I already have the appropriate authority. I can do I can fire an employee when it comes to that. And he, like you were saying, doesn't really feel the need to codify this into law because he thinks that it's already granted to him.
Imagine it's a case of he's not using it according to the committee enough. And I think you can see that at DHS to a certain extent too, and people get frustrated with DHS. Then they all of a sudden there's legislation that comes because they're not acting. And there's always, a balancing act that I think any secretary tries to achieve. But Congress is known for impatience, as we've seen time and again.
That's right. And now's a good time to take a break. We'll continue with our discussion after this break and a word from our sponsor. And you're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote. And be sure to request your special federal savings.
If you're a federal manager, you deal with a lot of information. Here's a tip on breaking through the noise. Join the Federal Managers Association to have a voice on Capitol Hill. And to get filtered news and information specific to managing your workforce, join the 50,000 other federal managers who already subscribe and read the free weekly e-report, fedmanager.com. I'm Todd Wells, Executive Director of the Federal Managers Association, and I approve this message.
You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm joined by Eric Katz from GovExec, Jason Miller from Federal News Radio, Zach Roundnitz from Fierce Government, and Joe Marks from NextGov. So I thought we'd continue our discussion. Jason, you had some thoughts about Windows XP, and we've all been reading in the news about how Microsoft is finally giving final notice that
exactly.
There's no more updates.
Well, what's interesting about XP is it's been around, I think, for 7 or 8 years now, and it was actually considered by many, one of Microsoft's better operating systems, and people didn't want to move off of XP to some of the other ones. But Microsoft, as you said, is giving up support of it, and there's been several articles about whether there'll be cyber concerns now that if you're still on XP and Microsoft stops doing Patch Tuesday and such. And I think that's a concern, but I don't think it's paramount. I think what's paramount, more or less, is you've got to move off XP and do your applications as you move into Windows 7 or what's it up to Windows 8 now? I lose track. Are those applications going to be working well with the new operating system? And I think when I talk to CIOs and you know, when I do my show, Ask the CIO, that topic of XP usually comes up. And it seems like everybody has a plan in place that they're doing. They're doing the testing. They were hopeful to make the April deadline. But it's the government. We know how that works, unfortunately. And I think sometimes they will be behind. I'm not sold on the fact that this is a major cyber hole yet. Now, 6 months from now, if they haven't updated, if they haven't moved off XP, I could see that being a problem.
I think Jason's got that exactly right. The concern, I think, is not so much that there are cybersecurity vulnerabilities when you remain on XP. It's that government agencies are still using outdated technology that's not being updated anymore.
Well, we're on Windows 8 right now. I just got my new laptop. And so XP is still being used by about 27% of the Windows folks. So is it that the agencies, is it something that they're reluctant to change off of because of their client base, or is it just inertia?
It's cost. I think there's a cost factor. And even if you budget it with the reductions and sequestration and then you have furloughs, you do have a series of, okay, do we really have the money for this? Or can we just, you know, it's like a car. When do you buy a new car? Well, if I could put another $1,000 in my old car, then I can put off buying a new car. Eventually, you're going to have to buy a new car. And I think for a lot of agencies, they're moving off XP, but it's a tough process. It takes time and it takes money. And Microsoft can give you a year, a five-year notice, and we're all procrastinators. So I'll throw that on the, you know, if your papers due Monday, Sunday night, you're still writing it. At least I was in college. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, yeah. I think we all work back from the deadline, right?
Exactly.
I read something interesting the other day about Partnership for Public Service wanting to do civil service reform. And again, it's like some of the ideas about IT. It seems to be on a huge macro level that they want to shift from, you know, all the GS grades and the senior executives into five
buckets.
Buckets.
Well, yeah. It's a term of art in the workforce.
Yeah, and any thoughts on is that just dead on arrival, or is there items from their proposal you could adapt?
Well, it's not exactly all new. It's sort of a retread of some old ideas, and some of it could have some momentum. I think that they're a little too macro in their focus as far as the whole thing becoming a law at once. They want to completely change the way federal employees get paid, move away from a set amount to every year it would change based on what's going on in the private sector. And I'm not sure that that would be very popular in Congress right now. You know, most Republicans would say that federal employees are way overcompensated compared to the private sector, whereas Democrats say the opposite. And so it's just sort of, I think the status quo is probably bound to remain.
Unfortunately, the status quo. I would tend to agree with you in the fact that you've seen pockets where changes to the GSA schedule work. I think DHS has had some pockets in some of their TSA people, maybe. Zach, I don't know, maybe you're a little familiar with that workforce issue, but you've seen the GAO, you've seen some scientific at NIST, where there's pay banding, or at least a different type of making sure people are getting paid market rates. But I think changing the entire GS schedule, even though it was, Eric, what was it, from 1949, Truman was president, or Eisenhower was president the last time this was changed.
Exactly.
I don't think there's a lot of I don't know what the word is.
Momentum.
Thank you. Yeah, to do this, and it's a politically charged issue with the unions, because the unions are they do enjoy at least some of the status quo. They probably would like to see some changes in a different way, but I tend to agree that I just don't think it's going to go forward.
I think one interesting thing that the partnership proposed was a requirement for senior executives to have some degree of experience in either more than one sector or more than one agency before they can reach the SES level. And I think, you know, on an abstract level, that sounds like a great idea to have people have a sort of a broader view of how organizations work. But I think, again, if you're actually going to enact it into law, it's hard to see how exactly you'd enforce it. You know, are the people going to actually have meaningful experience, or will they just go for, you know, a year or less to working in the nonprofit sector or in the private sector, just to get that, you know, on their resume so they can achieve that bureaucratic hurdle?
Yeah, you can see, this is not my field, but you can see that things like that have worked pretty well informally in the State Department and Defense Department, where promotion is often based on having worked in a different State Department or something. And, you know, perhaps that's a good lesson learned.
And I think that the idea of moving people around is something that initially you've heard that SES was therefore, it's supposed to be a mobile workforce. You spend 2 or 3 years in one agency, you take that experience and bring it to another agency, and that's how you kind of work your way up the SES ladder. It hasn't worked well because I think people do get entrenched. You become an expert, and entrenched is a good way because you know what you're doing. You know the topic. You know the mission. So why would I want you to go? I mean, I don't want to move you in 2 years because I got to bring somebody else in and train them and have them understand the issue, even though that would be beneficial in some ways to the agency because of a fresh pair of eyes, they've got to find some happy mediums. And if you remember about the, I think Senator Akaka had come up with ways to reform the SES and a big push for the mobility issue. And it just never, again, there was no, to use Joe's word, momentum for it, even though people can all say, yeah, we think it's a good idea.
Right, and even more so blocking the momentum is the fact that the federal employee unions aren't really on board with this whole thing. They think it's an excuse to create more jobs for contractors, and that's something that they're obviously really concerned with. They want more insourcing, not outsourcing. So that's going to stymie some of the momentum for it.
Playing off the outsourcing, there's also that shared services push where I believe it's OPM is going to announce some new agencies that people are supposed to outsource their personnel management or their financial management to, because it's even though this has been, again, a topic that they have been saying that they want all the agencies to do, it seems to be only the smaller agencies that are taking advantage of sort of shared resources. Do you see any of the medium or large agencies accepting this avenue as a cost saving or as a more efficient way to do things?
So there's two things that are going on around shared services. The first one, the most immediate one, is financial management. And Treasury is in charge of that effort. And they are going to name new shared service providers in the coming weeks. I'm told it could be USDA is possible, and EPA is one, VA is one, even someone from DHS, CBP potentially is one. It depends who applied and if they got accepted and all that jazz. But right now, there's this the push from the administration is basically it's mandated to go to a financial management shared service provider when you're ready to update your financial management system. So no more money being spent on old systems. So right now, Commerce, HUD, and Coast Guard, now I guess all depends what happens with Coast Guard, but there's at least Commerce and HUD and Coast Guard are the three that I've heard that are actually moving toward a shared service provider. So those are some pretty large agencies. On the HR side, I've not heard about new shared service providers. I know OPM, this is something that when I spoke with Catherine Archuleta, I don't know, Eric, if you got the same thing from her, that talking about shared service providers, they want to be that for the government. And that's when we go tagging back to the beginning of the conversation around the IT modernization strategy. Part of the IT modernization strategy is to make sure OPM can support those customers through shared services. Now, they won't be a provider per se, as we think of them, but they will provide some sort of, you know, technology basis for agencies to use. Again, retirement services is a good example. Their security clearances, which is a whole separate conversation we could have. That's a shared service in many regards. The issue is going to be that there's a whole host of outstanding issues, but I'll just throw out, I think, the three that I see as the biggest ones. The first one is around capacity. If you're HUD and you're going to, I think they're going to Treasury's shared service provider, but I may have that wrong. Do I have the capacity to bring in anybody else? The answer, what I've heard from many, is no. It's one at a time, and that's it for the next 2 years. Now, there may be some who disagree, saying, well, that's where the private sector can help. But capacity is a big issue. The other issue is it costs money to change, to bring in more people. There's storage, there's technology, there's people. And I'm not sure that the agencies have a mechanism to get that money. I'm not sure OMB does either, or Treasury does. And the third piece of it is the private sector piece. Is if you're really looking for competition and innovation, why not open the door to the private sector? When I spoke with Treasury, their response was, well, look at all the failures that the private sector has already done. We think we want to go with people who actually have had success. So there's a host of others, but those are the three I see as the challenge to shared services.
And if you look at the big picture in IT, each year when the budget comes out, a big chunk of how Stephen Van Roekel, the federal CIO, expects to save money, or at least flatline tech spending in government, is through shared services. It's, you know, doing things once rather than multiple times, building systems once rather than multiple times. And, you know, each year when the budget comes out, he credits the fact that it's relatively flatlined since the beginning of the Obama administration to the fact that to new shared services. At the same time, you look at the GAO report just came out a couple of days ago saying there are 90-some unnecessarily duplicative services in government. So clearly there's impetus to do something, acknowledgement that you can save money this way, but a lot of work yet to be done.
And I think there's a, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room on all of this is the ongoing budget cuts and sequestration. Jason, you mentioned OPM wanting to sort of branch out and become more of a shared services provider for all of government, and part of that is their human resources services, which they want to help train HR at every agency. But at the same time, they recently had to lay off 300 people from that department. So it's sort of a balancing act. You know, you have to spend money to save money sometimes, and I think that's really going to be a challenge moving forward.
And the other piece of it, just to kind of tag along, is the workforce issue. Is do they have the people in place to manage these types of shared services? This is not a skill that's, you know, you're not talking about systems administrator, you're not talking about even a program manager, you're really talking about a specialized skill. And I'm not sure if that skill has been developed across the government, whether it's HR, finance, or anything else. And if you look at a lot of the other shared services that were begun under the Bush administration, some of them were pretty good. I mean, if you look at cybersecurity as an example, a lot of people are using the Justice Department's what they call the CSAMS tool. This is for certification, accreditation, help. Others, they're not using so much. A grants line of business really never took off well. So it's really been a mixed bag. And I think the one difference, though, going back to Eric's point, this time around is the budget crunch. Mm-hmm. And I think people realize, right, I can no longer afford to support my own financial management system.
We're going to stop right here and have a word from our sponsor. When we return, we'll wrap up our discussion, and you're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're ending our last segment of the show, and I thought we'd talk about the pay raise, the 1% that the federal employees finally received after years of pay freeze, and the proposed, is it 3.3% pay raise that well, I'll ask you, Zach, what do you think? Do you think it's likely to go anywhere, this 3.3%?
I'm skeptical. I think that proposal was something that the Democrats in the House came out with. And, you know, obviously, if the Republicans in the House aren't going to support it, then I don't see it going forward from there.
Yeah, it was put forward by three Democrats, all of whom represent a large swath of federal employees. So you could question whether this might have been an election year proposal that sort of rally up support heading into the election. But yeah, the Obama put forth in his budget 1% for the second consecutive year after 3 years of freeze. I think that's probably likely to just quietly slide through exactly like it did for the 2014 raise. It was sort of no one really talked about it that much. It just sort of happened because Congress didn't say it wouldn't happen like they did in previous years. And 3.3, the unions all love it. They've called the 1% raise pitiful. They hate it. It doesn't do enough to keep up with the cost of living and doesn't take into effect their health care costs and all that. But Unfortunately, I think they're probably likely to get the 1% again.
I think the other piece about the 3% proposal is there's certain members of Congress who are leaving. Jim Moran, is Frank Wolf.
Frank Wolf, who's been the biggest Republican advocate for federal employees over the years.
So I think it's kind of like, hey, I got nothing to lose. I'm not going to get reelected because I'm leaving. So why not just put it all on the table? At that point, they should have done 5% or 7% just to really cause a firestorm on the Republicans. But I think I'll go on a limb a little bit and tell you 3.3% may not be the final number, but I maybe won't be surprised if they go a little higher, if 1.5% or even 2%. Now, maybe I'm being optimistic, and I'm a Redskins fan, so maybe that's part of my problem, or Caps fan,
right.
I guess.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah, that's sad.
So maybe that's why, but I think that one of the things that AFGE and NTU and some of the other unions and employee organizations did a really nice job of during the shutdown and then post-shutdown is really presenting to members, hey, look at all the people at work in your districts that you're affecting. This is not just a Washington, oh, those Washington people, they don't deserve money, but these are 88% of the feds live outside of D.C., and look what they do each day. They're border patrol, they work at VA hospitals, they provide services that your constituents like and need, and maybe, you know, treating them this way is not a good idea for you at home as well as in just because you're being hard on D.C. So I maybe I'm being optimistic. I don't know, Eric or Zach, what do you guys?
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good point, and AFGE especially is, you know, they're going on the airwaves on taking out TV spots, highlighting what individual federal employees do every day, just like you were saying. So they're not trying to get rid of this idea that they're just nameless, faceless bureaucrats who are slowing everything down and getting in the way all the time. And, you know, if you look at historically, the federal employee pay raise is usually much higher than 1%. It's, you know, historically been 3, 4, 5, 6, 7% even. And it's really been trending downwards, obviously, culminating in the freeze for 3 years. And this 1% so is much lower than it has been. So it really could bounce back up.
Do you think that the effects of that shutdown has caused Congress to sort of back off on the federal employee bashing that had been going on for years? Because the public did have an opportunity at that time to see the value that the federal workforce does for the country.
In Congress, I would say that it hasn't completely ended the bashing. We talked about those VA bills, and there's a lot of other similar things floating around on the Republican side. I think it definitely helped from the administration. President Obama, when the shutdown ended and there was a deal when the budget deal was reached after the shutdown ended, the new employees had to pay more into their retirement pensions. President Obama called Chris Van Hollen personally, who's the head of the Budget Committee for Democrats, ranking member, and told him, I'm not going to target that anymore. So he's sort of backed off, President Obama has. And I think there is a little bit of momentum to back off, but there certainly is still bashing going on.
Well, as you said in the beginning, the Ryan budget, the Republican budget in the House that was passed, that was a lot less forceful against or Fed bashing. And I think that's a good sign. You know, will the Republicans all of a sudden accept federal employees as worthwhile people? It's hard to say. I think, though, that you're not going to see as many proposals as you have in the past. And I think that there'll be much more lighter in the touch, like the 3-for-1 deal, I think, that they're calling for. Again, that's something we've heard time and again. And while it's a bit of a silly idea, because I've never heard a federal employee tell me that they're underworked, that's a much less it's much less of a penalty than cutting pay or making raising the retirement benefits, you know, increased by, you know, 5-7%.
Jumping to Eric's point about the administration, this is just a piece of historical arcana that occurs to me now, but I believe that after the Clinton administration shut down, one of the people that President Clinton called out in his next State of the Union address was a federal employee, and you know, called out the difficulties that he had faced when the government was shut down. And I don't believe that happened during this State of the Union. I mean, that's not necessarily anything you should draw grand conclusions from. It's just anecdote. But it doesn't seem as if President Obama himself has made federal employees, you know, part of the battleground.
I think, unfortunately, that has been the case. I was reading where the director of the FBI was testifying, and he testified that he's going to try to recruit about 1,000 employees to try to fill the gap of the over, I think it was about 2,500, 2,600 employees that either were left during the sequestration battle, if you will. Do you see that the morale or just the attrition rate, as the federal workforce said, enough of this, is slowing down or stabilizing in some way? Or are people adjusting and, you know, not fleeing into the private sector or retiring as much?
I think at the FBI, I believe they lost 2,300 employees to attrition as a result of sequestration and not being able to fill in those positions. And yes, like you said, they're looking to add 1,000 more. I think a big area of concern for them is getting up to speed on cybersecurity, hiring people who are experts in that area. And I think it's going to be a challenge going forward.
I think if you look at the attrition throughout government, it's definitely taken its toll. In the last 2 years alone, there's about 85,000, 90,000 fewer federal employees than there were prior to that. This is, I think, mostly because of hiring freezes and as a result of sequestration. And it'll be interesting to see whether that bounces back or the trend continues to slide down.
Yeah, Eric, I'm sure, as you just saw, has the numbers on this much better than I do. I know this much more by anecdote, but I started covering the federal government and federal technology 3 years ago and, you know, went out and started talking to people and developed my sources and got to know, you know, a couple dozen people. And by and large, the people I know in the federal government now are not the same people I knew when I started, because they've gone out to the private sector, they've gone elsewhere. And when you're talking about something as delicate and difficult as the relation between government regulation and technology, it's tough when you lose that kind of knowledge base.
I agree with Joe. It always pains me when I hear somebody retires who's been in government for 20 or 30 years. Rob Carey is the latest one, and I wrote a note to Rob saying, you know, what am I going to do without you? And he just kind of sent me a note back, you'll get by. But I think at the same time, this retirement wave we've been talking about is not going to come. And in fact, we had Jerry Buchholz on, who's the NASA Chief Human Capital Officer, I guess about 2 weeks ago now, to talk about a survey we did with Chico's. And her point is, well, number one is the survey told us, and it was about 16 Chico's have filled it out, and they told us that retirement actually was not affecting their agency a great deal, somewhat a little bit, but not a great deal. And that was impressive. And then the other thing that was surprising was Jerry said that she believes that the retirement wave has already come and gone. It really happened in 2009, 2010, 2011. And really what's happening now is you have a lot of older people who've decided to stay. They like their job. You know, the bashing and the pay cuts and the shutdowns are frustrating, but they're there for the mission. So I think what we're going to see is actually the retirement backlog, just to take it back to the OPM conversation, is going to slowly, it's been ticking down. I think it's going to tick down faster because I think there are fewer people who are going to retire in the coming months. Now, I may be proved wrong, but the wave that we've all been expecting where, you know, 30,000 people walk out of the door is just never going to happen.
Interesting. Joe, one last prediction for you. Do you what do you see moving forward in the rest of 2014 as a hot topic or a topic that so far hasn't been covered and is going to cause people to stand up and take notice?
Well, one thing that I think hasn't been covered, it certainly has been covered, hasn't been covered as much as it has, but it's the data thing that we were talking about earlier. It's whether agencies can begin the process of really sharing data better so that they can make operations more efficient. And the human side to that, I mean, the healthcare.gov and the concerns about data security there were one thing. Heartbleed, it looks as if, according to DHS today, the majority of really critical public-facing websites weren't affected, but, you know, because they're still looking at a bunch of other websites that are less critical than may have been.
Okay, well, actually, thanks, Joe. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's all the time we have for the show today. I apologize for that. Thank you for joining us.